Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Pamela Fuentes, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Christine Arce about her new book, Mexico's Nobodies, The Cultural Legacy of the Soldadera and Afro-Mexican Women. Christine Arce, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here.
Christy, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Actually, I'm from Los Angeles, California, born and raised. I went to UC Santa Barbara for undergrad and then did my master's at Middlebury College. And then I did my grad work at Cal at UC Berkeley. And now I'm an associate professor. I just got tenure. I'm an associate professor at the University of Miami.
Great. And let's start talking about the book. How did you come to write Mexico's Nobodies?
Well, it's really interesting because when I was doing my master's in political science, I took a course on Mexican history, and I just sort of took it out of interest because I wanted to know a little bit more about my own history, about my father's history. So I took a class, and in this book, the textbook that we were assigned that was almost 500 pages, there was three quarters of a page on the soldadera, and I was shocked. I was amazed. I found it to be absolutely scintillating that these women were such an important part of the revolutionary movement. And so when I went home and I asked my dad, I said, "Bob, you know, who are the soldaderas?" And he said to me, he replied, "They were the wives. I think they were the wives." I said, "Oh, the wives, huh?" And so really what that was sort of a way to sort of soften the description of the camp followers, the women that followed these men, but also participated actively through military engagement. And so by calling them wives, it was a way to sort of, on the one hand, diminish their active participation, but on the other hand, sort of soften it, you know? And so I thought that was really interesting because these wives actually were not always wives, they could be daughters, but they were also contracted employees. But they could also be, of course, cooks, prostitutes, spies. They could occupy any number of roles. And so I thought that was absolutely fascinating. And I also was sort of concerned because I had grown up in LA, and for a long time we only had a few Spanish channels, and we would watch these movies on the Mexican Revolution, and I'd see these women participating. So I found it very, very strange that I had been, even as a Chicana from LA, had been completely sort of immersed in this cultural imaginary of the soldadera when I only saw three quarters of a page written on them in the textbook. So it absolutely piqued my curiosity, and that curiosity sort of became an obsession that then turned into the book. So that's how I sort of began my research on the soldadera.
And what the book is talking about, the soldaderas, and the book has two parts, let's say this for our listeners. But you also talk about Afro-Mexican women, and you are trying to balance that out. You talk about the soldaderas, write about the soldaderas in three chapters, and about Afro-Mexican women in other three chapters. And in the introduction, you are telling us about how these two groups have been made invisible from several narratives, even when they are very much present as part of cultural representations of Mexico, of what is Mexican or lo Mexicano in the country and outside. Can you tell us about this relationship and this invisibilization? I don't know if that's a word, but I will use it.
Yes, actually, that's when I began my research and my critical inquiry, but right, formal studies into the roles of the soldadera, and I had moved on from political science to Spanish because I realized, a PhD in Spanish, because I realized that the humanities as such, but cultural studies allowed me to take on these studies in a more critical fashion than maybe history or political science would have allowed me. So when I began to study more about the soldadera, and I began to sort of voraciously read all the products that include cultural products, novels, films, that included soldadera figures, I came upon the novel La Negra Angustias. And then again, I was brought to another sort of shock about how an entire novel almost the only novel written about a female camp follower, a soldadera, who was actually not a soldadera, but a coronela, an actual military colonel, could be written about a black Mexican when, in fact, you know, blacks in Mexico are completely irrelevant as a considered irrelevant in the larger imaginary as a cultural, as a ethnic community. I mean, not until 2015 were they recognized, were they given the chance to identify themselves in the interim census. Not till 2015. So for me, that I came upon that second really sort of incredible, palpable paradox, which is the fact that a prize-winning novel would be written about a black female soldadera who actually wasn't a soldadera, who was, you know, not a soldadera only, but rather a military agent and actor and authority. So that is what sort of brought me to these two parts of the book, which in fact... some people found confusing. They're like, okay, so it's sort of split because it's about Mexicans, it's about soldaderas and Afro-Mexicans. And yes, it is, but the irony of it or the paradox is sort of, there's two faces to that. Because on the one hand, the soldadera is a nobody. The ninguneo, the soldadera, isn't necessarily an image because, I mean, you can't go into a taqueria without seeing, you know, images of Adelitas with canadas. Yeah. I mean, it's part and parcel of what it means to be Mexican. One of the most important songs in Mexican folklore, La Cucaracha, is about a soldadera. People don't know about that, but it's the way in which they've been sort of... demeaned as sort of camp tramps, you know, to, for the lack of a better word. Or on the other end, the Adelita, who sort of idealized as sort of the Marian figure, sort of the angel of the home, and, you know, the hogar that sort of follows her men into it valiantly into battle. There's these two sort of binary opposites, but on the same token, by the same token, women, female blacks in Mexico have been completely left out of the historical narrative. At the same time, they've been the subjects of some of the most important films. Now, I'm not saying all of Mexican golden era, golden age cinema, the golden era Mexican film from like the 30s to, you know, the end of the 50s, there are prominent black figures. I mean, we have four that I discuss in the book, four important films. And when I saw those films, when I read the novel, and then when I actually went back to the history and the historiography of the colonial period, I was shocked by the fact that they really occupied such an important part of colonial society, yet have been sort of excised out of the national narrative by virtue of course, the post-revolutionary discourse of mestizaje. But also, and then when I came to find out many years ago that the second president of Mexico was actually also an Afro-Mexican, it became clear to me that the ninguneo, the nobodiness of both figures was striking and stark at the same time that the arts have picked up where, I mean, at least that's what I argued, where history and history has led off. Because even though soldaderas are presented in very sort of pejorative manners, either as the angel or as the slut, and the mulata is almost inevitably sort of the seductress. It was incredible to me that a novel, a prize-winning novel by a very important writer, including the rumbera films, which while the rumberas aren't necessarily black, it sort of plays onto this displaced blackness that's triangulated through the Caribbean. In addition to actual historical figures, such as the one that graces the cover of my book. And so that, when I came upon that image many years ago, I was also sort of taken, I mean, the actual title of the image, it was indexed as, up until 2 years ago, Soldadera de Michoacán, the woman, the Afro-Mexican colonel that's on the cover of the book. When in fact she wasn't a soldadera, she was a colonel, she was a coronela from the Zapatista army, which would have been Morelos or Guerrero, not Michoacán. So for almost 100 years, in sort of the visual archive of Mexican revolutionaries, I mean, it was lost for a long time, and when it was recovered, it was misnamed as soldadera from Michoacán, and then only recently recovered a proper name as Carmen Robles. And so in, if you do like Google searches, you'll find Carmen Robles was actually the transgender Amelia Robles, and people were confusing this very image that's been sort of a poster child in certain, to a certain extent. I say that only because the very important exhibit, Blacks in Mexico, that happened by Sagrario Cruz Carretero and that circulated for 6 years in L.A., Chicago, I think in Paso, that was one of the primary images that's in the catalog, and that was also on some of the flyers that was that showcased the important contributions of Blacks and Mexican culture. So the paradox of these two figures, where on the one hand the soldadera is blinds by culturally saturating, I mean, the imaginary, both in film and corridos and photography. I mean, you can't, there's no end to the images that are glorified of the Adelitas with the cananas and the rifles and all that. I mean, even in the period, they were sort of glorified and sort of staged. There's these staged images by Casasola and the people that work with Casasola and other revolutionary photographers, delighting in women and all this sort of military heraldry, where at the same time, they weren't able to get the right to vote till, if I'm not mistaken, 1959. So there's that irony on the one hand, and then there's the irony on the other hand, where one of the first sort of short opera acts that happened after Chavez, and created these schools where they wanted to sort of cultivate a Mexican expression to opera. One of those three-act operas was La Mulata de Córdoba. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is stunning, that we can have these cultural products that showcase Black women, that showcase soldaderas, and yet there could be no collective consciousness that thinks about them in their particular contributions to Mexican history. It's to me, it's deplorable that up until recently we didn't know who that Black Afro-Mexican soldadera was, that she was called Soldadera de Michoacán, when in fact she was a military agent and colonel. And so I found one of the images that's both in the archive and national in Mexico City, but that was showcased in John Mraz's excellent book on the photography of the Mexican Revolution, that another image that showcases her in the middle as Coronela Carmen Robles, but then in the archive in Mexico City, in the INAH's visual archive of the Mexican Revolution, it's indexed as Soldados y una Soldadera, when indeed she's in the center. So there's this incredible irony and paradox that I'm attempting to grapple with in the book. And my argument sort of stridently embraces the role of the art, both in defaming and disfiguring the soldaderas and Afro-Mexican women, who are almost always seductresses, almost always enticing, but almost always sort of playing off almost very common, tried and true tropes that I think, and I argue, come from the Caribbean. The very familiarity of Mexicans with Caribbean cultural production, the Cuban theater, the slapstick theater of the Cuban troops that sort of came in through Merida and through the port and through Mexico City, through tropical sort of fetishizing tropical music in the rumbera films, and all there's all these ways in which Blackness, and female Blackness in particular, is necessarily sexualized. It's sort of ontologized as like a sexual otherness that sort of comes in and leaves. I mean, that's the legend of the Mulata de Córdoba. She has no name, no history, no background, but is from Córdoba. So that's the irony. She's from Córdoba, but nobody knows where she's from, and then she disappears in a cloud of smoke on a boat and disappears back into, you know, the port, you know, escapes from San Juan de Ulúa as she's about to be, you know, tortured by the Inquisition. I mean, that's how the legend goes. So that's sort of the way in which those two parts connect through the discourse of otherness and ninguneo and nobodiness that operate in very different ways, as I've described.
Yeah, and I think one of the richness of your book is how you bring all these voices together and you connect them and all of these cultural representations, and how these images are there, and somehow we knew little or nothing about the actual names or these actual figures. So just to go on some specific parts of your book, in chapter one, you talk about the spaces of the soldaderas and how they were there in these scenarios for the Mexican Revolution at the beginning of the 20th century. And one of the parts that caught my attention is when you are talking about the train and the railroads and how these the train as well as the soldaderas were means or vehicles to create this revolution. Can you tell us more about that relationship?
Yes, thank you. That was one of my favorite parts, actually, to write, because I think, as I argue in my book, that one of the sort of stronger theoretical interventions I make is about the occupation of place and space and the way in which women erupting onto the sort of revolutionary scene, leaving their small towns, not by the dozens or the hundreds, but by the thousands. You know, as Elena Poniatowska said, I mean, if it weren't for the women, they would have ran home, the men would have run home crying, no? I mean, there was no commissaries, there was no infirmaries. For men to eat and sleep and to operate on the revolutionary, in the camps, in the fields, they needed someone to help them out. And these women didn't just provide services, they also provide extremely important espionage services that allowed them to occupy multiple spaces. So at the same time they may be preparing their tortillas for their Juan, they were also maybe transferring messages, or they were guarding the municiones, or they were doing any number of other very military roles, and then maybe actually intervening, picking up the rifle and taking over. I mean, there were thousands killed on the battlefield, and they're completely unremunerated, completely unacknowledged as military agents. So the fact that they could occupy both the domestic and the public spaces is what I say is a radical intervention for women, because in a very traditional, that's where I make the argument, like the mujer decente, I mean, there's a way in which that's racialized in terms of class, racialized, but there's also a very specific class understanding of what it means to be a mujer decente. But when you have these women en masse out in the countryside and in the cities occupying very public spaces, it creates a sort of, it unsettles hegemonic notions of female and masculine spaces, and so also what is public, what is private. So for that, I think that it radically undoes, I mean, even at the moment when you have photographers insisting on taking these pictures of girls with cananas and rebosos, I mean, sort of delighting in that, but at the same time staging those portraits, that undoes what it means to be a traditional woman in Mexico. In chapter three, I talk a little bit about the John Reed's interpretation of the Soldadera Elisabetta. And when I read that, gosh, I guess 20 years ago, I was incredibly impressed. I mean, it was wow. I mean, 100 years ago, this woman sort of lost her husband, or who even knows if it was her husband, and that's what he interpreted it to be, or her boyfriend or whatever, and then up and takes off with an American to get a bed for the night, and then goes back to the sergeant that picked her up and says, no, I'm fine with him. So, I mean, that is, there's an incredible amount of power and agency that he interprets as absolute abjection, as sort of a female abjection, that in the custom of her sex and country, the way in which Mexican women blindly, almost brutishly follow the men, I interpret it in a completely different way. For me, it was absolutely riveting that she could take off with a man, and then he describes it, even the townspeople having like a baile, like it was some sort of like festival, and then the musicians come at the door. I mean, they think it's absolutely fantastic that this young woman take off with a gringo for the night, and then she returns as if nothing happened. And that's where my intervention comes, is that moment between is and as if, and as if, I mean, as if nothing happened, she's preparing her tortillas for the Capitan, Capitan Romero. That to me signals a critical moment when women are occupying spaces, changing the notion of place and space in a really radical way. And so that to me was, and you see that in the films. then again, the films usually end with the woman being domesticated. I mean, you can, you know, like Enamorada, I think that's what it's called, the one
with Maria Felix.
The Maria Felix film. I mean, all the different films. I mean, she comes in as a very sort of, I mean, she's a different figure, but that film in particular is interesting because, you know, at the end they're always sort of domesticated, their fire is squelched by their maternity. I mean, that's the typical sort of paternalistic discourse that sort of is able to deal with strong female figures. I mean, when it's particularly when they're sort of these motherly figures, or they become motherly towards the end. That's what sort of vindicates women in the end, is their ability to take care of the man or their child. So for me, it was really, really important to highlight the way that radically changed notions of womanhood in Mexico, because it's no coincidence that they weren't. I mean, because the suffragist movement, middle class, upper class Mexican women had been organizing for many years. Olcott wrote a beautiful book about the female suffragists and advocates for the vote in Mexico and the different female center campaigns in Mexico. And it's no circle. I mean, for me, there's no way to misunderstand why women were not granted the vote immediately when they were supposed to. And in fact, why they were actually denied their place as revolutionary heroes. I mean, many of the women, both middle, lower, and upper class, even Leonor de Mañón did not get her revolutionary pension, and she devoted her entire wealth to the revolution and to forming the White Cross for Carranza, and was left penniless and couldn't even get her autobiography, which is fantastic, published until Clara Lomas sort of recuperated it, put it together, and published it, I don't know, like 40, 50, 60 years later. So that's what the first part of the book and what the sort of theoretical interventions are there with regards to space and place. And I didn't talk about the train. I'm sorry, I got cut up. But with regards to the train, that is, for me, it was fantastic because, yes, the men occupied the train alongside the women, but the women were up on the train making an actual home out of this mobile vehicle, like one of the most important vehicles of the 20th century with regards to modernity in Latin America. Se le fue el tren. I mean, it's the trope par excellence of modernity. It's the emblem of progress for the Porfiriato. Thousands of miles of train were installed in Mexico at the expense of the peasantry. And so that retaking of that space and actually not just making it a military vehicle to invade and to sort of allow the troops to travel quickly, but actually to make it a living, breathing home. It's fantastic. Bolaño's film La Soldadera sort of does a really good job with that because it becomes sort of its own character in the film. And there's so many incredible shots of the soldaderas resting underneath the train, praying underneath the train, giving birth on top of the train. I mean, and there's also documentary images from, of course, the Casa Sola archive and others of the women on the train. So part and parcel of that sort of disruption of the space has to do with the way in which they occupied it. And they were the last ones. I mean, the soldiers, first the horses and the coroneles, the coroneles and the generales, you know, they got to occupy the inside of the train and the horses. And then the soldiers from diverse ranks, and then the women. The women were hanging in the lurch underneath or maybe on top. If very seldomly did they get to occupy the center. So that famous picture that I also analyzed in chapter one of the soldaderas sort of getting onto the train is really interesting because it sparked a whole discussion that John Raz sort of documents in his book on photography. And it was, again, just like the cover of the book, it was disappeared for like 40, 50 years until Gustavo Casasola recuperated it to put it in his collection of revolutionary photography, and he found it and then was able, and it recirculated all over the world, and he put it Las Adelitas, our revolutionary women. And so that sort of became the poster child for female intervention. And then there was an argument by John Raz and others. I've heard the argument in different ways that they weren't actually soldaderas, that they were food sellers. Oh no, that they were prostitutes, because the prostitutes would have gone into the trains with the generals. oh no, that they couldn't have been soldaderas because blah blah. And so that's what sort of generated for me this larger discussion as to what does that image mean, because it's one of the most important and most circulated images of the adelitas, of the soldaderas, and there, we don't even know for sure that they even were. We didn't know what year it was published. I mean, he later in his book is able to give it a place and a time and a moment, but at that point it's irrelevant to me when it was actually taken, because already the impact and the indexicality of that image as a visual relic of the revolution, but also as an index and an icon for Mexican womanhood and revolutionary womanhood, has already been there for almost 60 years when Gustavo Casasola recuperated it for his anthology of the photographs.
And I'm talking about these cultural images and how important they are. I would like to bring the conversation to music. You have already mentioned Las Adelitas or the song La Cucaracha. And these corridos as part of the Mexican Revolution, La Adelita, La Cucaracha, La Valentina. What is behind of the names of these songs in regards to real women during the revolution?
That's a great question, because that's also what piqued my, I mean, as soon as I sort of dived into the three quarters of a page that stimulated and piqued my interest, I was able to unravel this incredible archive of knowledge of female participation. And one of those is precisely the role of women in the corridos. And most Mexican children, most Mexican people, Chicanos, we're all familiar with the cucaracha. I think I heard it the other day on my neighbor's kid's toy. It's a song and a sort of a sonic sort of souvenir of that revolutionary moment that does not give a proper name to the persons behind that. So thus, it's not even considered, at least by traditional corrido folklorists, as a proper corrido, because corridos have a very sort of set, I mean, it is a malleable, flexible, fluid form in the sense that they're not all the same. I mean, they're octosyllabic. They can have any number of estrofas, but one of the most important with regards to the revolutionary period components of the corrido is that there be a name, place, and date. So usually, so this is corrido de, Benjamín Argumedo. So there needs to be like a name and a last name. And in 1915, miren lo que ha sucedido. There needs to be sort of a declaration of a place. And that's part of the performativity of the corrido. And all of those sort of classical sort of narrative elements that are part and parcel of the corrido are absent. Ana María Sobek wrote a fantastic book on the role of women in the Mexican corrido, and talks a lot about the fact that I think she collected 32 corridos that featured women, and of those, only two mentioned the woman by name and patronymic, which is a veritable corrido sort of standard. You have to have at least the first name, if not, and usually the last name, and the place that the battle took place, all where everything is located. So when we get La Cucaracha, I mean, it's basically lyrical, like no, no, no puede caminar, and it's basically talking about a camp tramp, a camp slut that gets all the troops sort of excited. I mean, but it's incredible that a film was made, one of the most, like, a really popular film with, of course, La Doña was in it. Infinite renditions by I don't know how many different genres of music. I play La Cucaracha for my students. Gosh, I play ska, traditional versions, infantile versions, kid versions, like, tiene agua, no puede caminar. There's any number of versions of La Cucaracha. There's a great one that I talk about in my book, which is a Zapatista version of La Cucaracha, which is really, really racy and prurient, that talks about it's making fun of the Catrinas who wouldn't help the soldados, the revolutionaries, and it leaves the cucaracha in a really pitiable state, sort of riding on a donkey with snot running down her nose and her legs up in the air. So it's a way to sort of very, very much put women back in their place. Hmm. Not as revolutionary heroes, not as agents, but as entertainers. But it actually has a larger history than that. Sobek and other scholars date it back to the independence corridos, to an older variant of a corrido from the Mexican independence. So it's not clear exactly when it originated, but it became popularized by the Villista troops. And the other ones, the Adelita, Leonor Mañón, makes the argument that that's based on one of the nurses from the White Cross, from the Carrancistas. So she does that in her book, but that nobody really knows. There's infinite stories about how La Adelita, but that in fact it was based on a real nurse, a real woman that followed her coronel into battle. And when he died, she took on the revolutionary cause as a nurse, maybe a 14-year-old. The most convincing sort of the historical point of fact for that corrido is actually Mañón's account, which some people reference, but nobody really knows. And then Valentina is completely lyrical. It's, you know, si me vas a matar mañana, matame. O sea, I mean, it's all about, you know, the sort of typical female, the supplicant appealing to the female wiles, and que me mates una vez, and sort of that sort of insistence on male prowess, masculinity, but also the idea of machismo and death, you know, sort of right away. So the Valentina also is supposedly based on a real woman. I mean, it has a proper name, but nobody knows. There's different hypotheses. I wouldn't dare to venture to claim anyone as correct, because it's hard to impossible to know. I mean, even when we have actual visual archival images, it's been almost impossible to find out who the names, who those people actually are. And that's in the Casa Sola archives, let alone the corridos. But the most convincing one for me is Leonor de Mañón's account of La Adelita as one of the White Cross nurses up in northern Mexico.
And now we're going to move some centuries back to open the conversation on Afro-Mexican women, because the second part of your book titled The Blacks in the Closet opens with some revealing demographics during the colonial era that I think it's important to bring to the conversation. You mentioned, for instance, that in 1810, just about to get started the wars of independence in Mexico, well, what is today Mexico, free blacks numbered 10% of the population. Why, taking into account these numbers, Afro-descendants were not included in the national project immediately after the independence?
So what's really important of that, and there's been a ton, really voluminous and incredible work done by colonial scholars and historians, but not a lot by cultural historians, which is why I think my intervention is important. And I just read some other facts with regards to Veracruz and the Cuenca and the Sotavento, that, for example, in Tlacotalpan, those numbers in around 1810 were even higher. Of the 3,000 people, half were free blacks. The other half were indigenous groups. Well, it's not half. It was of the 3,000, let's say like 1,400 were blacks, 1,200 were Indians, and 228 were Españoles. And in other places, such as, I think he says, Coatzacoalcos and Alvarado, blacks numbered up into 80% of the population. So there was an incredibly vital and vibrant free black class. And so that's what sort of gets ignored in the narrative with regards to slavery, because there's been sort of a singular narrative with regards to the transatlantic slave trade that I think the historians have done a really good job of undoing, because in Mexico, while there was certainly chattel plantation slavery, particularly on the coast where there were ingenios, azucareros, there were sugar plantations, coffee and cacao plantations. So definitely blacks were deployed to work in these larger plantations. In Cordoba, there was a lot of plantations. That wasn't necessarily the model. They were also employed to work in the mines and in the cities. So Mexico City had a very important slave population in addition to a free black artisan population. So what's been recuperated through the archival work of the historians is, in fact, the very important contributions of blacks early on in the colonial period and throughout the independence movement. So when independence happens, as a lot of people have documented in their work, what sort of ironically erases blacks from the map, unlike the, you know, the often touted caste systems that, you know, creates a visual taxonomy for blackness and Indianness that then, you know, separates them. But unlike this caste system, when the second president comes in, he also undoes the caste system, which then erases blackness from the archive. It no longer, and you can, by becoming members of the castas, they weren't relegated to a subordinate status as blacks, or as bozales, or as lobos, or you know, the lower you were on the caste system, the less access you had to certain sort of resources and certain possibilities, but that also sort of erased them from the ethno-historical map. And so that was sort of a consequence of that 100 years later, when the Mexican, aftermath of the Mexican Revolution, and then the process of sort of creating and crafting a Mexican national identity. As we know, Mexico was not a singular homogenous place. I mean, everyone very much identified with their city, with their town, with their region. I mean, Oaxaca is not Veracruz, is not Chihuahua. They're radically different communities, indigenous languages, cultural practices, accents. So in that zeal to create sort of a Mexican identity, not only do we have, you know, operas being, you know, commissioned by the Chavez sort of talleres, not only did we have mestizaje and Vasconcelos creating this sort of larger narrative of inclusion through the idea of mestizaje, but blackness was included in that. I mean, the raza cósmica includes blacks, but it's not highlighted. It's sort of thought of as a relic in the past. And then what becomes imported are discourses of blackness from the Caribbean, which I think is really important, and of course the northern border of the U.S. So even though they had such an important part of the colonial, I mean, they were part and parcel of the colonial project. You couldn't have Mexico today without blacks. There were more blacks even imported to Mexico, more African slaves imported to Mexico than in the United States. So why is it that they're so completely invisibilized? Well, because, you know, 200 years ago, manumission happened really early on, unlike the last two countries, Brazil and Cuba, who were the last two countries to manumit slaves. They integrated much earlier, even during the colonial period, as free blacks. So there was a vibrant free class. They integrated into indigenous communities and then became sort of indigenized. So there's a lot of really important work that's recuperating and looking at the roles of blacks, not just as the henchmen of the Spanish, which they certainly were. And so there's been a lot of focus up until recently on the antagonistic relationships between Indians and blacks. But in fact, there were blacks that actively integrated into the indigenous communities and in very important ways. Really, to become an indigenous person, you didn't necessarily, there wasn't that insistence on phenotype for different indigenous communities, but rather on culture and language. So there was an affinity to, because of the sort of animistic practices of Afro descendants and indigenous. So even in terms of their spiritual and philosophical practices, the animism, there was incredible similarities that allowed them to quite easily integrate into indigenous communities. And when the Spaniards, and then the more remote the community, the less likely a Spaniard was able to incur in that. So they were less likely. And then once, you know, through integration, they stopped looking less and less phenotypically African, and thus were not considered African. Also, it was not in their benefit, particularly for land titles, to not be to be African. So there's this there's a strategic way in which they also appropriated indigenous community indigenous identities, because then they weren't able to have land rights. And we see that still to this day. I mean, Afro-Mexicans are not even allowed to consider themselves a proper community. They have no access to land because they have no land titles, because they're not indigenous. They can't have ejidos. So even the ejido system that was part of, you know, one of the good things that came out of the revolution, that the blacks weren't able to access those. So it was also a strategic move, both throughout the colonial period and afterwards. But then they were just sort of erased as an ethnic category. For good reasons. I mean, obviously, I mean, to eliminate discrimination, but then that just wholeheartedly allowed Mexico to deflect its history of slavery and to deflect its black cultural practices onto a sort of tropicalized Caribbean that, you know, through Veracruz. I mean, early on, you know, La Mujer del Puerto, there's all these ways in which Veracruz becomes a sort of like vortex of tropical otherness that has to always be blamed on Cuba or you know, the few blacks that were there during the period that sort of stuck, you know. I mean, in the Puertos. But in fact, they were part and parcel of the, not just Mexico City, not just the ports, not just, you know, the Costa Chica, but the northern mining communities. They were important. I mean, they got the blacks to work in the mines, in addition to the indigenous communities, but they were cohabiting in these haciendas that were servicing the mines. I'm sorry, in these misiones, I'm sorry, that were servicing the mines. And that's part of what I talk about in the fifth chapter, where I look at an Inquisition case of a runaway slave woman, Antonia de Soto, who has this sort of fantastic life as a swashbuckling runaway slave, bandida, muleteer, who travels around freely for 7 years, who takes peyote, who ingests psychotropic drugs, who has these sort of visions with San Antonio and with the devil, who makes a pact with the devil. I mean, that's a trope of the time during the Inquisition, to make pacts with the devil. But it was interesting to me. I mean, so you can mine the archive and find blacks overrepresented in the Inquisition for sexual dereliction, for moral depravity, for whatever. Also because Indians were considered neophytes, so they weren't subject to the inquisitorial mandates as blacks were. So they're overrepresented there as sexual, as derelicts, or as, you know, any other number of things. So, but besides that, what was fascinating to me is that in this case was the way that Antonia de Soto was part of, you know, Nueva Vizcaya. She was easily cohabiting with Tepehuanes, with mestizos, participating in their spiritual practices, in their curanderismo. At the same time, she was beckoning and sort of summoning this colonial Catholic sort of Christian consciousness to say, oh, you know what I did was bad. I turned myself in. I mean, so there's some debate as to whether or not she turned herself strategically in, because if you turned yourself in, then you got less of a sort of sentence. I mean, it was strategic to turn yourself in. So it's not clear in the documents that I examined why precisely she turned herself in, but you can sort of read between the lines and probably imagine that somebody was about ready to turn her in. So she went ahead and did it first.
And one of these powerful figures that come from this time, and it is related with what you are telling us about the Inquisition, is the mulata. Who were the mulatas, and what is their relationship with magic, witchcraft, and sexuality?
There's also been a ton of historical work. I think Joan Bristol, Laura Lewis, incredible historians and anthropologists have done some work recuperating the role of blacks with regards to, I mean, the famous book, Gonzalo Aguirre Beltrán, Magia y Medicina, is one of the most important books that talks about the contributions of black Mexicans, of Afro-Mexicans to herbolaria, to curanderismo, but to healing, these sort of practices of healing. Now, that gets tied into black magic, and that's part of what the argument is, because over and over again, there's this way in which blacks are accused of appealing to the devil, of contaminating the white's foods. I mean, so on the one hand, you have whites. I mean, they're not whites. You have Creole, criollos, mestizos, and white or whitish Mexicans, completely dependent on their servants to make their chocolate. They were known as the chocolateras. I mean, they were famous for making, I mean, Mexican chocolate. I mean, abuelita. I mean, those were the black women who made the chocolate, you know, the black women who made the sort of potions. And so a lot of the cases, if you were to look at Joan Bristol's book and some of the cases that I use as evidence in my particular reading of this case and of the legend of the Mulata de Córdoba, is that they were often summoned to undo the very black magic that supposedly a slave or a servant had imposed upon them. So there's these fascinating cases. There's one particular case, which I found really interesting, where a woman claimed, from Guanajuato, claimed that her servant had cast a spell that, you know, produced all these very unsightly sort of poxes and welts on her body. And so in order for her to heal, she summoned these mulata and indigenous, they were very much women, medicinal healers who, with both Catholic prayer invocations of different saints, but also these sort of medicines, were able to heal her from the black magic practiced by her aggrieved slave. So there's this incredible paradox by which blacks are both needed and sort of despised and dispelled at the same time. And so because blacks and criollos and women in particular were the sort of repositories of all this medicinal knowledge. And it's also hard. I mean, there's a very fine line between what's considered magic and what's considered healing. And so there's been a lot of work on that by really important anthropologists and historians that talk about, like, the, you know, that the almost sometimes it's almost the it's in the eye of the parish or the parroco, the church priest, to decide whether or not they're practicing black magic or they're actually just, you know, deploying traditional healing and traditional medicine. So there's a very fine line between the two, and it sort of depends on how badly either the slave owner or the mistress wants to get back at her slave. So it's really difficult, but it's over and over again. And the Inquisition cases are replete with women, supposedly black women, curanderas, deploying these sort of magical things. I mean, putting menstrual blood in the chocolate, leaving hairs behind, you know, and whether or not that's true, it's sort of irrelevant, because they got sort of blanketly identified with these derelict medicinal practices at the same time that both female and black Mexicans were, you know, bone setters, tooth pullers. They were occupying these jobs as empirics, because there was a very, very important lack of trained physicians, particularly in the outposts. Like, I'm sure in Mexico City it was a different situation, but when you're in these areas, these colonial centers, these mining centers like Guanajuato, you know, Zacatecas, all these areas, I mean, that was an important role that they occupied. Joan Bristol in particular makes the argument that they occupied this place of power by being able to service the colonial elites at the same time that the elites were terrified of them, that they were going to, you know, appeal to the devil and cast a spell. So it's that plays itself out, because over and over again in the culture, I mean, even in the films, even in the Rumbera films, I mean, the one film that was made of the Mulata de Córdoba, she's a white mulata, but of course there's the son jarocho that's sort of featured in the first like 5 minutes of the film is ay mulata, tu magia me hace daño. There's always these sort of underlying undercurrents of sort of sickness and infirmity attached to black female sexuality. So it's not uncommon. I mean, it happens across the Afro-diasporic world, You see it all the time in Cuba and in the Caribbean, but in Mexico, it's very much deployed, in part because, like I mentioned earlier, indigenous people were not subject to the Inquisition, but blacks were. So, and blacks were creolized in a way that many indigenous people were not, unless they were mestizo. So they occupied the sort of in-between space in the urban centers that maybe some indigenous people didn't. Of course, I mean, indigenous people occupied many of the same roles, but Afro-Mexicans and particularly free blacks were able to sort of circulate in ways that were beneficial to them, but also place them, you know, straight in the eye of the hurricane with regards to accusations and magic. So you see that over and over again in the films. I mean, I was just in Tlacotalpan, and one of the decimeros, that's a like the poets, extemporaneous poets, had one of a beautiful decima about a negra preciosa me cautivas. I mean, it's over and over and over again. I mean he just made it up on the spot, but it's almost always the same language of sort of seduction, of that almost like displaces mestizo and white desire onto these powers, these sort of supernatural powers, which, by the way, I found completely present in the arc in the Inquisition case that I examined. The very same language of seduction is present in that case, where supposedly, and this is a documented case that was transcribed by four different scribes. By scribes and by the parish priests and then by the inquisitors in Mexico City, that she apparently seduced the devil and the devil seduced her, and then, you know. So at the same time she's dressing as a man and acting as a bandit and operating in a very masculine domain, she's also being seduced by the devil and seducing, you know, others, you know, who fall in love with her, and then, you know. So it's almost identical language with regards to black female subjectivity. So that is part of the story of nobodyness. I mean, it's incredible that we have this short opera that was then, you know, recorded, I think like 10 years ago, in a really beautiful recording that was done by, I forget the name of the conductor. You have a film by no less, with a screenplay by none other than Javier Villarrutia. You have poems by Javier Villarrutia. You have Pablo Moncayo writing the libretto. These are not unimportant people. These are some of the most important cultural figures in Mexico at the time, and they're writing about, you know, mulatas and, you know, and this legend that really not a lot of people knew about outside of Veracruz, which I found really interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and talking about films and these representations, you have mentioned some of them during our conversation. But you talk carefully about them in your book, several of the films of the Mexican Golden Age era during the 1940s, 1950s. And you are talking about some of these movies, and you mentioned that there are like these attempts to contend with the problem of racism against blacks in Mexico. But you have a really important criticism about these films. For instance, I remember when you were talking about Angelitos Negros, this famous movie, you are talking about some of the flaws of this discourse in there. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. That was another thing that sort of I found jarring, is that that films, important films, were being made about blacks in Mexico at the same time that they were considered completely irrelevant. So it's Angelitos, and if they were, I mean, La Mulata de Córdoba wasn't sort of a blockbuster, so we can't make that argument about that, but there were important people participating in its collaboration. I mean, both from the writers, the screenwriters, and the filmmakers, right? But with regards to Angelitos Negros, it was remade twice by Joselito Rodriguez. It wasn't made once. It was made once in black and white with Infante and then Rita Montaner, and then it was made a second time. And, you know, I think it's Marilyn Miller, I'm not sure, somebody did some tracing, and apparently when they were in D.C., it was one of the most checked out films in the now defunct video stores, but when there were video stores, it was one of the most checked out films at the time, and this was, I don't know, maybe like 20 years ago. So it is a very culturally relevant film. And what is important here is that it attempts to talk about this racism. I mean, at the same time, it deploys blackface. So, I mean, that's a very sort of thorny issue, too, because it's very common at the time to use blackface. The Cuban opera Bufos, from which a lot of Mexican cinema and Mexican rumbera films draw directly from, I mean, the Bufos were an important part of Mexican art at the time in music. That's what brought the danzón. That's what brought all kinds of sort of tropical music to Mexico, was precisely the opera Bufos, which were, you know, all the rage in Mexico. They always deployed blackface as a sort of a strategy to distantiate Cuban whites from blacks. At the same time, they incorporate blacks into their cultural repertoire. So that was what, how, I mean, even in 2011, I saw a skit in our local Miami TV station with this famous comedian, I forget his name, who has La Santera Teresa, I don't know her name, and he's wearing blackface in 2011. So it's part of the cultural repertoire. So yes, I realize that that can be a thorny issue, because it was particularly in the first version of Angelitos Negro was deployed at the time, and it was very common even in American filmmaking. So it's you know, not necessarily anachronistic to say, you know, it's racist practice. It is a racist practice to use blackface, but it's not uncommon at the time. So I can see. But what is interesting is that they don't use Afro-Mexican actors. They use Cuban ones or Puerto Rican ones. And even those actors, such as Rita Montaner and then the Puerto Rican actress in the second version of Angelitos Negros, they feel they have to sort of blacken up in order to sort of really legitimate that blackness. And so my argument there is that by using blackface, even in the second version, it creates a narrative, oh, look, these poor blacks, we're feeling this is a terrible practice for a mother. I mean, there's nothing worse in Mexican society than for a mother to reject her child. And that film is painful to watch precisely for the way in which the white mulata rejects the child. And that, of course, is part of a cultural repertoire derived from the Cuban play. I think it's Cañé's play, and of course the North American film, I'm forgetting the name of it. I mean, so it's playing off other narratives that are very similar. So it's not a Mexican, and Angelitos Negros is a derivative, is riffing off other cultural products that talk about the same issue. But nonetheless, by overdoing that, by insisting on this sort of Caribbeanness, it's really distantiating any possibility of blacks being relevant to Mexico. So it creates an argument against racism. At the same time, it deploys racist practices and makes it almost irrelevant when you can't find people that look black enough. So it creates a very specific argument with regards to phenotype and blackness. Blackness can, I mean, so if you don't look black, you can't. I mean, so that's part of what people today claim about blackness, that in Mexico is that, well, they're not really black. They don't really look black. They're not black anymore. So, well, then how are you quantifying or qualifying blackness? Is it only with regards to phenotype? I just went to a round table in Tlacotalpan at the Encuentro Jaranero with Afro-Mexicans from different regions, the Costa Chica, from Mexico City, and I think one from Veracruz, and the four of them were on the panel, and one of the most important figures, she made a calendar of important Afro-Mexicans, a 12-month calendar featuring different people who identify as Afro-Mexican, and her argument was, you know, we don't look like they do in Brazil. They also imported slaves way after we had abrogated and abolished slavery in Mexico. There wasn't, it was a plantain, a chattel plantation model, which created a separate, the mestizaje is part of the discourse in Brazil as it is in Cuba, but I mean, there wasn't that sort of very specific chattel plantation model that operated with the Casa Grande in the Casa Chica. So what does it mean to be black in Mexico? Do you have to look a certain way. And she argues fervently that no, because when you do that, then you erase all the contributions that have been made through the last 500 years. I mean, blacks came with the first Spaniards. I mean, we know that. The second president of Mexico is black. I mean, we had to wait till Obama to get a president here. In Mexico, they had a president who was black and indigenous like 200 years earlier. So that, yes, that can be argued to be, you know, part of how Mexicans are not as racist as the U.S. But by utilizing that U.S., the U.S. discourse of race, you're also not acknowledging the incredible invisibility that you're then, and the disappearing of blacks from the historical, cultural, but most important, like the sort of political, cultural, historical imaginary. So that disappearing act is just as racist. And so that's what these films do by displacing it all into the Caribbean. And it's not, I mean, there is an important, Mexico's part of the Caribbean, it's part of the Gran Caribe, and not just Veracruz, we have Merida. There is this incredible, I mean, it was called at one point on a French map, the Mexican archipelago. So there's this archipelagic thinking with regards to Mexico's part of the greater Caribbean. So it is. I'm not in any way stating that it isn't. In fact, the opposite. But by using that as an excuse, you then can talk about, well, you know, it's not like it was in the U.S. Well, no, it actually wasn't. We had more blacks in Mexico than in the U.S. Or it's not like it was in Cuba. Well, you know, Brazilians were the last to abolish slavery shortly after the Cubans. It's a very different relationship to blackness, and it's a very different sort of model. So, and it was much earlier on. I mean, they stopped bringing in slaves. I mean, it sort of very much had sort of slowed down. I don't know. I can't remember the dates. Maybe like 3-4 decades. By the end of the 18th century, there were no blacks really being shipped in, not as many, and that's at the precise moment when it had been sort of accelerated because of the sugar boom and the coffee boom in Brazil and in Mexico, and I'm sorry, in Brazil and Cuba. So yeah, I mean, but if you only qualify blackness with regards to phenotype, then you're undoing and you're erasing 500 years of history.
Yeah, and I don't want to end this conversation without talking about the amazing Toña la Negra. I would like to hear how do you place Toña la Negra in this narrative? And also, it's unavoidable, I think, to talk about Veracruz music and all the heritage of Afro descendants in Mexico.
Well, it's really interesting because I learned a lot, you know, as a lot of Chicanos do. I learned a lot about Mexico through my dad's, you know, by going there every year, but also by you know, living with my Mexican family intermittently for years at a time. They'd come and go, but also because my dad was a huge fan of music, and he was a musician himself. He played the guitar, played the mandolin, and part of being Mexican, part of the Mexican, I'm sorry, musical industry, Los Angeles was sort of a nodal point in that. A lot of even the recordings happened in Mexico. The distribution, the companies, there was a lot of distribution of Mexican music in Los Angeles. So as in terms of like the circuits and the centers, LA was a really important place. So my dad would always go to downtown LA and buy records. And one of the records, a lot of the records he bought was Toña la Negra, because he was a huge fan of música veracruzana, son jarocho, but also música tropical, you know, boleros. So I remember the first time I pick up a cover of an album that's, I don't know, 60 years old now, and I see a black lady gracing the cover, I'm like, Toña la Negra. And I was like, huh. And so I asked my father, oh, yeah, she's one of the most important singers. She had this incredible voice. She was the intérprete mayor de Agustín Lara, and this and that, and this and that. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize blacks were that important. He's like, well, there's not that many. But yeah, she was really, really important. She was from Veracruz. There's a lot in Veracruz, no? So part of like that idea, that discourse that they're nobody's fault of their own. I mean, I've been in Afro-Mexican communities such as Tamiawa, such as in Veracruz, where people sort of didn't realize they were Black, even though they're Black. Phenotypically, they have very strong phenotypical features of Blackness and have learned that as a sort of, as an identity. And so people can criticize that and say, well, they're just adopting that, they're learning that. But I talked to a lot of people through the Proyecto Afro Tamiawa who were able to really talk about what that sort of realization was, and a sort of epiphany of this lost and disappeared and unspoken about history. And so a lot of people got really emotional when they talked about it. And I thought that was really interesting, because how can you look at yourself in the mirror and not know anything about them? So they're doing this real important job by the community members themselves to recover and recuperate this sort of lost heritage with the arts of fishing, with the particular ways in which they fish and shrimp. And I'm sorry to go back to Tonya La Negra. The irony of her as a cultural figure is that she is one of the divas of the Mexican bolero, in part because she sang música tropical, and also in part because she was one of the Agustín Lara's most important sort of singers. And she's in, I don't know, I think over 40 films. And so she's the darling of Mexican golden age. I mean, she makes, I don't know how many cameos and how many films, and I don't know how many albums she made. I mean, she's one of the most important figures. And she's actually given a name, Doña La Negra. And so it's important because that was popular at the time, particularly with Cuban performers, to be given this sort of nickname, La Negra, Negro, sort of authenticated your sort of musical virtuosity as a rumbero, or as a singer, as a songwriter, as a musician. There's this way in which being closer to Caribbean Blackness sort of authenticated, sort of validated it. And so the scholar Rafael Figueroa makes an incredible discovery when he interviews people who worked on these films, like these elders, these people who worked on these films, that they would actually replace Mexican mestizo-looking musicians with more Afro-Cuban-looking musicians to sort of create this. There's this way in which Blackness is fetishized only as a cultural sort of product in this realm of sort of exoticized tropicality. And Tonya La Negra operates within that realm. I mean, she's as Mexican as they come, claimed and heralded as one of the divas of Mexican music. By one of the most important Mexican songwriters, Agustín Lara, and yet her Blackness is pretty much ignored, you know, or sort of explained away by her relationship to these Caribbean cultural musical forms. I'm sorry, musical forms that she participated in. And so, in some of the films, it's really interesting. I think I talk about it in my chapter on Doña La Negra, where I talk about Doña La Negra, that when she's playing a jarocha, at least in the visual archive I saw, her face is sort of whitened up. Oh. When she's playing a rumbera, she's allowed to be a little more black. So that's really interesting to me, how Blackness and whiteness plays itself out in her as this figure that sort of incarnates Mexican Blackness at the same time it openly ignores it. No, and so, but it's visually, and I'm sorry, it's sort of sonically articulated in this audiotropic landscape through her voice. I mean, there's her Blackness is part of what makes her voice so special, and that's where that film I talked about, actually, the Negros Mi Color, becomes important, because that film actually puts that into play. I don't know if you remember that film, but Negro Mi Color is about a white mulata, so it deploys the typical tropes of mammies, black mammies, and mean white mulattas who don't want to accept their Blackness. But what that film does talk about, which is really important when we think about Doña La Negra, is that Blackness becomes sonically articulated. She can't disguise her Blackness in her voice, and that's actually what makes her, as a marginalized woman who's been dumped by this white lover, that's what makes her a superstar. is her voice. And that's what she inherited from her black mother. And that's what she, that is, she's unable to disguise the blackness in her voice. And that's what that film, which is an okay film, but it talks about really important issues in that it talks about, even though it's, you know, it's sort of like, it's sort of cliche. It deploys all the typical cliches of mulattes and black women and this and that. But that part of it I found fascinating because she's a white woman that in the film can only sing with a black timbre and a black tenor. And Tonya La Negra is able to sort of capitalize on that sort of fetish at the same time become one of the most, I'm not going to say she's the most, but she's one of the most beloved sort of singers in the Mexican musical repertoire, such that, Chicana in LA can pick up the album. I mean, I grew up with the music, just like I grew up with Agustin Lara, just like I grew up with all the boleros, I grew up with all that music partially because my father was a musician and my family was very musically inclined and we would always play that music. That's how I got to Tonya La Negra, and it just sort of, between reading the novel La Negra Angustia, seeing the films of the Soldaderas, and then listening to Tonya La Negra, it became clear to me that these women, while very different, all had something really in common, and that's their elision and their nobodiness, you know, what I call nobodiness, you know, their ninguneo.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Kirsi. We've taken up a lot of your time. I'm pretty sure we could talk more and more because these are not the only topics you cover in your book. But before saying goodbye, can you tell us what other projects are you working on right now?
Sure, I'd love to. I just came from a trip to Veracruz, and so one of the projects I have sort of in the works, and I've just published a short article on it, is on Son Jarocho as like the sort of transnational politicized movement. And so the sort of vaivenes of Son Jarocho as sort of a democratizing movement that sort of looks back to this really what at one point was a moribund musical genre, which is, typified by La Bamba. So for me, it's really important. And a lot of people are working on that too, but it's incredible how what was at one point considered a more of a musical genre is now becoming sort of a transnational movement. There's encuentros jaraneros there was an active impulse by Mexican cultural advocates in Veracruz and Tacotalpan in different parts to resuscitate the fandangos and Son Jarocho 30 years ago in 1979. We had the first encuentro, and it's incredible now here in Miami. We're going to have our first encuentro in exactly 1 month. And I've been participating in that in the sort of emergent sort of jaranero group. So, well, there's a lot of talk of cultural appropriation that the Chicanos that you need to sort of go back to the countryside. It's created this, it's become a vehicle of political dissidence of what I call riffing off Anna Dini, sound dissent, these sounds of dissent. So there's groups in Acayuca and Veracruz that are working actively using Son Jarocho and going back to what they call the señores, los ancianos, la gente grande, both female and male, to talk about what the fandango can cultivate with regards to community building. And with the recent violence in Mexico, they've used that as a way to dissent, as a sonic musical dissent, but also an alternative to alternative sort of political discourse. Even in a documentary I just saw the other day, they talk about it as a utopia, where gente grande, gente chamacos, like young people, elders can come together around the tarima. I mean, that's a 300-year-old practice that dates back to Afro-Mexican practices. So it's, for me, incredible that has taken on an international expression. Now, whether or not they're understanding it, whether or not it's been appropriated, I know a lot of people... my friend and colleague Rafael Figueroa says that if you didn't grow up by the Rio Papaloapan, which is the Rio of the Sotavento where Son Jarocho was born, then you have no right to play Son Jarocho. Some of the elders are like, wait, well, why are these Chicanos so interested in us? And at the same time, they're proud of it. So I think it's a fascinating musical, cultural, and political phenomenon. You know, there's Jaraneros in Mexico City who were, you know, denouncing the 43 disappeared kids in Ayotzinapa, using son jarochas, using décimas. So it's a very powerful musical vehicle that can both entertain and be fun, but also be a source of dissent, but also cultural recuperation. And that's the role it played in for the Chicano. So that's one of my projects. The other sort of smaller project I have is that I'm working on a transcription, a bilingual edition of the Inquisition case I mentioned earlier. It's really important to me, with a critical introduction and notes, and I'm collaborating with other scholars. I had to put it on the side because when I was working on it, I had sort of to go up for tenure, and then my dad got sick, and there was all these other things. But it's the work is all done. But for me, it's really imperative that not just scholars who can have the time and luxury to get the Archivo General to read this account of this runaway slave who in 1691 took off and became a cross-dressing bandit and then, you know, sort of made her own fortune in northern Mexico. I think this is such an incredible account both for Afro-Mexicans, for women, and that undoes the traditional narrative that opposes antagonists, that creates antagonistic relationships or insists on the antagonism between blacks and Indians. I mean, this case really blows all that up. So it's a smaller project that I'm hoping to get done. It's already been transcribed, about three quarters of the way translated. I'm not a colonial scholar. The paleography was hard, but I finally got through that with the help of Mexican colleagues who are colonial, you know, paleographers. Arturo Mota helped me immensely on the paleography. So that is what I'm hoping to get done in my sabbatical. And then my third project, which I have a few chapters already written on, is on Zapatismo and the Corrido. As you see, I'm really interested in popular music, but also popular balladry. So the corrido was an important vehicle in the Mexican Revolution, as we talked about earlier. One of the most important cultural expressions of Mexican female revolutionary power was through the corridos. Even though they didn't know who they were, you know, Delita, even though they were sweethearts, sluts, or femme fatales like the Valentina, but nonetheless, the corrido form current and contemporary Zapatista activism is what I'd like to think about, the relationships between the revolutionary corrido during the revolutionary period, the ciclo zapatista, the bola suriana, and the way in which corridos in the contemporary and language and oral expression in the contemporary Zapatista movement. There's been a lot written on Zapatismo, of course, but my particular bent has to do with connecting oral balladry with the sort of political oral discourse of indigenous Zapatistas today, in particular in the writings of Sucomandante de Marcos. So those are my three projects. I have a little bit done on each one, and so hopefully this year I'll get one of them finished.
All of them sounds great, and I think all of them are more than necessary. So I will be looking forward to knowing how they end, and I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners and colleagues would love to know more about your projects. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really, really, really enjoy it. Take care.
Thank you so much, Pamela. Thank you. This was really wonderful. Such an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.